broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
The Soviet Army left Afghanistan in February 1989. The Berlin Wall fell in November of the same year. East and West Germany were reunited a year later, and the Soviet Union ceased to exist in December 1991. The near constant threat of global nuclear war between the two superpowers that had dominated world politics for four decades vanished almost overnight. Victory for the U.S. side in the Cold War seemed complete. The Soviet defeat in Afghanistan was followed so quickly by the collapse of the Soviet state that one former U.S. ambassador observed that the defeat led to the rapid collapse of a 500-year-old system, and the last great European empire came to an end. The Afghan War also marked the beginning of a new era, the era of global jihad. Bruce Rydell, in his recent book, What We Won. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're very pleased to welcome Bruce Rydell back to our studio today to discuss his most recent book, What We Won, and the current situation in the Middle East and South Asia. I say welcome back, Bruce, because it was about a year ago that you joined us on the program to discuss your work as a policy analyst and your books, The Search for Al-Qaeda and Deadly Embrace, Pakistan, America, and the Future of the Global Jihad. And because of his direct interest in current affairs, I've also asked Don Rush, Associate Program Director and Senior Producer, News and Public Affairs for Delmarva Public Radio, to join us in our discussion as well. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Bruce, and the Writer's Edition.
Thank you for having me back, Al. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Don, thank you for joining us today as well.
Good to be here.
We're also pleased to welcome faculty and students to the studio from the Salisbury University's Political Science Department. We hope to have time for a few questions from them in the second half hour of our program. Bruce Rydell is Senior Fellow and Director of the Brookings Intelligence Project, which is part of Brookings Institution's new Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. He also serves as a Senior Fellow in the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. Bruce has as well been a senior advisor to the last four U.S. presidents on South Asia and the Middle East while working as a senior member of the National Security Council. It's been a year, Bruce, since you were on our program, and in that time you've published, I believe, two additional books, Avoiding Armageddon, and now this latest work, What We Won. Tell us about What We Won, your book, and why it's important today for us to understand our country's secret war in Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989 and how that impacts on what we're facing in the Middle East and South Asia today.
The war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, looking back at it a quarter of a century later, was a pivotal event. the United States, working with a number of other countries, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan most importantly, but also Great Britain, Communist China, and others, put together a coalition to support the Afghan Mujahideen, freedom fighters, as they were called by many at the time, who, over the course of a decade, were able to defeat the Soviet 40th Red Army that had invaded Afghanistan on Christmas Eve, 1979. We can now see that that defeat was a precipitating event in the downfall of the Warsaw Pact, the Berlin Wall, and even the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It wasn't the only reason for all of those things happening, but it was a precipitating event that helped to make them happen. This came at a relatively small cost for the United States. Not a single American was killed in the war in Afghanistan. Not a single American was injured in the war in Afghanistan. The covert war cost roughly $3 to $4 billion of American taxpayers' money. I would say that there has probably not been another program in the history of the federal government that had so much bang, literally, for the buck. And yet we can also see that not only was it the end of that era, but it was the beginning of the era of the modern global jihadist terrorist movement. The pivotal figures in the plot to attack the United States, for example, on September 11th, 2001, 9/11, was Osama bin Laden. And Osama bin Laden learned his battlefield skills and developed his connections in the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, where he was a soldier engineer on the side of the Mujahideen, kind of a combat engineer. So I think this is a war that is little appreciated, but had enormous consequences, not only in terms of ending the Cold War, but in terms of beginning the era that we live in today. And yet it's been relatively understudied. What most Americans know about the war comes from a movie, Charlie Wilson's War. It's a great movie. I love it. But I don't think it's the full story of what happened there.
Bruce, who were the actors in that war? You outline them in your book. And what role did the United States play?
The main actors, of course, were the Russians and the Afghans. They did almost all of the fighting and almost all of the dying. The Russians put about 100,000 soldiers into Afghanistan at its peak. They lost maybe 13, 14,000 killed. No one knows exactly how many. The morale of the Soviet army, which had not lost a battle since 1941, was shattered in Afghanistan. The morale of the Soviet Politburo was shattered in Afghanistan. America had wanted to create a Russian Vietnam in Afghanistan, and we succeeded beyond our wildest imaginations. The Afghans fought on both sides. There were Afghan communists and Afghan Mujahideen. The overwhelming majority of Afghans supported the Mujahideen. They saw the Russians as a foreign invader, atheists trying to come into their country and impose atheism on them. It was a nationalist and Islamist victory for them. But they were the biggest losers in the war, really. Over 1 million killed, 6 million driven out of the country, become refugees in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And when the war ended, it really didn't end at all for Afghanistan. The civil war continued on, and it continues on to this day. The American role was basically being the quartermaster for the Mujahideen. We raised funds for them. We got other countries to match the funds that we raised. We purchased equipment for them. And then we handed it all over to the Pakistanis. And the Pakistanis trained the Mujahideen. They gave them the weapons. They even provided advisors and commanders to go into Afghanistan and fight against the Russians. We did none of that. At the peak of this operation, the CIA had less than 50 people working on it, and most of them were in Langley, Virginia. Again, the disparity between the outcome And the amount of people and money involved in it is staggering to see. This was all done deliberately, of course. The United States didn't want to put boots on the ground. We wanted the Russians to put boots on the ground. We wanted to fight a war covertly, and we wanted to keep our hand as hidden as possible. If you study the business of intelligence and covert operations, you'll find there's dozens of books about failed intelligence efforts, from Pearl Harbor to September 11th. I wanted to look at a successful intelligence operation and see what lessons we could learn from how this operation was done for the future.
Well, you talk about this as a secret war. In what way was it a secret war for us?
The American role was never discussed publicly. Two presidents, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, provided arms and equipment and money to the Mujahideen, but in public they never talked about it. They talked about the war in Afghanistan, but not about the American hand. The American press and other press over time figured out the story. It became increasingly obvious what was going on. But it's interesting that as late as the 1980s, the American press, by and large, did not talk about the American role. They were willing to give the White House the benefit of the doubt and keep a covert war, that is the American part of the war, out of the public domain and not write about it. Towards the end of the war, when we began providing uniquely American pieces of equipment, like the famous Stinger surface-to-air missile, the American role became more and more obvious. Of course, the Russians knew right from the beginning. The Pakistanis knew. The Saudis knew. But the American public, in general, was not told about the covert war. Now, one of the interesting things about this for my research for the book is that Jimmy Carter, the president who started the war for the United States, never wrote about it in his memoirs. Jimmy Carter wrote his memoirs in the 1980s, his several times, actually, and never talked about the war because he was a good American. It was a secret war. This was a secret project. Therefore, he didn't discuss it at all. His national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, wrote his memoirs, never talked about it. I went to them in the course of writing this book and interviewed both of them and said, in essence, you know, you played an enormously important role in a historic changing event, and yet your side of the story has never been put out there. Consequently, they were both very gracious in giving me very long interviews once I had presented it to them that way.
You mentioned Carter, and Carter got us into this secret war, and he had a particular strategy that he envisioned for our involvement, and then Reagan picked up. President Reagan picked up the war when he became president, and he made a change later in the strategy. What kind of change did Reagan make, and what was its impact?
President Reagan, in his first term, basically just followed what Jimmy Carter had done. The first 4 years of the Reagan administration, there were no real changes in strategy, in the coalition. There was a minor increase in the amount of money. But in his second term, Reagan decided to increase the pressure. He and his director of Central Intelligence, Bill Casey, became convinced that they could win the Cold War, that containment was not a policy that had to go on indefinitely, that the Soviet Union could fall apart. Very few other people believed it at the time, including within the Central Intelligence Agency. And they decided to reduce the covertness by providing American state-of-the-art weapon systems that no one could claim the Mujahideen had found on the battlefield.
No plausible deniability.
There was no plausible
anymore.
Deniability. Once you began using the Stinger surface-to-air missile, shoulder-fired surface-to-air missile, all pretense of this being a covert affair and that there was no American hand was lost. But I think one of the key things to emphasize, though, is that while Reagan and Casey were eager to do this in their second term, the real decision maker was the president of Pakistan, a dictator, General Zia-ul-Haq. He was the man taking all the risks. It was his country that was in danger of being invaded by the Russians if they came to the conclusion the way to end the war was to take it to the sanctuaries that the Mujahideen had in Pakistan. When the war began, Zia wanted it to be kept boiling, but not too hot. He liked to say, I want it to be simmer, but don't boil over. By 1985, he'd come to the conclusion that it could boil a lot hotter, and he could still get away with it. And it was Zia's decision to ask for stingers that precipitated the Reagan administration then going forward.
Well, there was a role that the Saudis played in this, and part of that role was also the initiation and funding of volunteers. And it seems to me that what you call the volunteers that went to Afghanistan to fight, to some extent brings us to the issue that we're facing today in the Middle East. What was the role of the Saudis, and who were these volunteers that came?
The Saudis had two roles. Role number one was financier. Very early on, President Carter made a deal with the then Saudi king, King Fahd, that for every American dollar provided to Mujahideen, the Saudis would provide an equivalent amount of Saudi money. So when we gave the Mujahideen $100 million, the Saudis matched that. Saudis actually did more than that. The Saudis also arranged for private money, not government money, but private money to go to the Mujahideen. And particularly in the early days of the war, this was the largest single source of money going to finance the war. The current king of Saudi Arabia, the man who just became king a few days ago, Prince Salman, was in charge of this private fundraising effort. At its peak, he was raising $25 million or more a month to support the war. So their biggest role was financier. The second role, though, was volunteers. Several thousand Saudis went to Afghanistan and Pakistan to fight with the Mujahideen. Osama bin Laden is, of course, the most famous, but there were many others. And volunteers came from across the Muslim world, from Egypt, from Iraq, from as far as Indonesia. Now, in terms of the outcome on the battlefield, the so-called Arab Afghans, as they were named, were pretty marginal. Even Osama bin Laden, although he was probably the most important, they didn't do very much fighting. The Mujahideen didn't really respect them that much. Some of them were there mostly to get their picture taken and then go home. But in retrospect, we can also see that connections were made then, narratives were developed, myths were created about what they had done. And those connections, those narratives, those myths all began to form what would become, a decade later, the organization Osama bin Laden founded, Al-Qaeda.
In these kinds of strategies, you point out that there are always unintended consequences. And even though the strategy that we employed that helped bring down the Soviet Union and the defeat of the Red Army always has unintended consequences. I would suggest perhaps that we're facing some of those unintended consequences today. Could you tell us a little bit about what you see anyway as the unintended consequences and how we're struggling with those consequences now?
Well, one of the unintended consequences was what happened to Pakistan. Pakistan became the home for several million Afghan refugees. This had a very destabilizing effect on the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's in that border region today where al-Qaeda's core leadership continues to operate. Pakistani culture also was filled with weapons. Pakistanis look back upon this era and call it the Kalashnikov culture, when a country was so flooded with weapons, virtually everyone got them. In other words, law and order in a significant part of Pakistan broke down during the war, an unintended consequence. Another unintended consequence was the development of the volunteers. They came to the conclusion afterwards that they and the Mujahideen had defeated the Soviet Union. They kind of airbrushed our part out of it completely. They also came to the conclusion that if an Islamist movement like this could defeat one superpower, it could defeat the other superpower. And if you look at what al-Qaeda and associated groups are trying to do to the United States today, an important way to understand their strategy is they are fixated on this earlier war. And their intention is to do to us what was done to the Soviet Union. And their plan, therefore, involves dragging the United States into quagmires, like the war in Afghanistan, like the war in Iraq, and to do to the American Army what they did to the Red Army.
Bruce, have we taken that bait?
I think to a certain extent we did take that bait. Now, in the days immediately after September 11th, I don't think President Bush had any option other than to send American forces into Afghanistan to prevent another 9/11 type attack. But he certainly took the bait when he went into Iraq. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq. The diversion of American resources from Afghanistan to Iraq turned out in the end to be devastating for both wars. The war in Afghanistan was underfunded, under-resourced, and the war in Iraq created a new al-Qaeda, an al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is what is today called the Islamic State, or ISIS, or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, is al-Qaeda in Iraq as it has mutated over the years. Yes, I think to a certain extent we took the bait. That's all much more obvious in retrospect than it was at the time, of course. The strategy of Osama bin Laden, in short, has always been to replicate the Afghan War of the 1980s, only with a different superpower in the trap.
So where are we now? And we've taken the bait for 13 years now, I guess it is. We've been involved over there, and we've had troops on the ground, and then not troops on the ground, and now troops on the ground again to some extent. Where are we in the Middle East and South Asia, and what in your opinion have we done well, and what are we not doing so well?
In terms of fighting the war against terrorist organizations like al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, I think what we've done well is what I call defense. It's much harder to attack the United States today than it was in 2001, and much harder to put together a complicated plot like the 9/11 plot that involved dozens of people inside the United States, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, over a long period of time. Anyone who goes to an airport knows our defenses are much stronger. Behind the scenes, our intelligence services and those of our allies around the world are much more closely connected in terms of sharing information, sharing analysis about terrorist organizations and individual specific terrorists. We've also hardened our physical facilities. Prior to 9/11, you could walk into the United States Capitol building, walk around, walk up to your congressman, give him your few thoughts, or whatever you wanted to give them. Today, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
The United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, you used to be able to drive in anytime you wanted to. You can't do that anymore. Improving our defenses, in short, has its costs as well as its benefits. What I think we've been wrestling with is the offensive part of this war. we've known from the beginning that we have to do something about those sanctuaries and safe havens where al-Qaeda and associated groups plan operations, like Afghanistan, like Pakistan. We've tried several strategies. We tried the lots of boots on the ground strategy. George Bush tried it in two wars. Whatever you think of the merits of the decision to go into those wars, leave that aside. It hasn't worked in terms of eliminating the sanctuaries. In fact, there are more sanctuaries today than there were then. President Obama has tried a lighter footprint, trying to use drones, trying to build up the local capacity of our partners, trying to get our allies to do more. The role model for this lighter strategy was Yemen. It's not working either. We haven't yet come up with an effective way of preventing the development of sanctuaries and safe havens. Now, part of that is not under our control. The last 3 years, since the so-called Arab Spring, has seen an enormous change in much of the Muslim world, in particular the Arab world. One of my colleagues at Brookings calls it the Great Unraveling. We have seen the old order of Arab police states fall apart. And in its place, we've either gotten new police states with new dictators, or in many places, no state at all. Failed and collapsed states in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, and in Yemen. And it's in those places where al-Qaeda is thriving today. So the answer to the problem is, how are we going to deal with an Arab world and a Muslim world beyond it with so many failed and failing states? We can't put all those Humpty Dumpties back together again, even if we wanted to send 1 million American men and women overseas to fight in them and spend our national treasury on them. We are, to a certain degree, to a very large degree, now in a situation where we don't control the dynamics of the situation anymore. We're going to have to manage them. We're going to have to try to minimize the threat. But the notion that there's a silver bullet out there that we haven't tried, I think, is just fallacious.
Of course, as Americans, we love silver bullets, and we think that it seems to me that we believe there's always a silver bullet somewhere. Don, jump in here.
I want to follow up on the question and the answer that you gave, because it seems to me that one of the things that's happened, and you sort of alluded to it, is that part of the problem is the really sort of the disappearance of the last remnants of what might be called Arab nationalism or pan-Arabism, and that in its place, in these societies themselves, they see themselves as being Islamic. For instance, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has been building a whole society and influencing its society even before the Arab Spring. Given that kind of ingrained fundamentalist Islamic view of society, which some suggest, for instance, can produce illiberal democracies. That is to say that the Brotherhood, for instance, in Egypt, would certainly want to win elections, but it's for the idea of basically creating an Islamic society. How do you then deal with that, which is much more amorphous than just simply utilizing military strategy or even propaganda, for instance, efforts? People have said, well, we need more propaganda, we need better message, or we need moderates to denounce. But it seems to me that a lot of this is very, very ingrained in the societies themselves and therefore is intractable.
I think you get to a very crucial point, which is the Islamic world is going through a tumultuous period of adjustment. The nationalist period, the post-World War I era, has largely come to an end. The state system that was created by the British and French a century ago, at the end of World War I, which never made a whole lot of sense, has collapsed in many ways. The border between Iraq and Syria, drawn by the French and British, no longer exists today. Islamic State has eliminated. And they're very proud of the fact that they've eliminated it. And yes, there's an Islamic revival. This goes back to the same period, late 1970s, the Iranian Revolution, the Mujahideen movements were all part of an Islamic revival that was going on. Now, let's be clear. The vast majority of Muslims reject the kind of terrorist violence that al-Qaeda and the Islamic State promotes. The vast majority of Muslims do not see Osama bin Laden as a hero figure. Maybe some did in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, but I think those days are long since gone. But this enormous process of change that's going on in the Islamic world, search for identity, I think is the best way to think about it, creates a backdrop. We've had similar periods in the history of Western civilization. Several authors, several commentators have made the argument, which I think is a good one, that the most apt analogy to what's going on in the Islamic world today is probably the 30 Years' War in Europe in the 1600s, a war in which a quarter or a third of the population of Germany was eliminated in 30 years, in which there were alliances and Catholic powers aligned with Protestant powers and then changed sides and back and forth. All the great powers got involved. My concern, though, is this won't be a 30 years war. This is more likely to be a 100 years war or a 200 years war because the issues are very complex. And because so far we haven't seen in the Islamic world a liberal democracy really emerge that is an exemplar for others to point to. Turkey, many people hoped a few years ago would be that. It doesn't look like it's working out. Certainly, our allies, the Saudis, don't fit into that standpoint. They're the last absolute monarchy in the world. The Arab Spring offered the hope that such a liberal democracy might emerge, and Egypt appeared to be the most likely candidate. Would have been enormously influential had it succeeded, but instead we had a coup in 2013, and basically we're back to the past in Egypt. Al-Qaeda is a beneficiary of that too, because Al-Qaeda's argument is the only solution to the problems the Islamic world face is violence, is terror, and jihad. In 2011 and 2012, people could say, no, that's not true. Look, we had a peaceful, largely peaceful revolution in Egypt. We've had a democracy. We've had elections. Al-Qaeda says, we told you it wouldn't work, that there would be a coup. Now, I'm not asking you to buy into Al-Qaeda's argument, but I think you can see they have a powerful propaganda point.
It seems to me that there are a number of corners here, because on the one hand, you have the rise of this fundamentalist ideology. But it's sort of like you've got, on one corner, you've got the conflict with the West. In another corner, you've got this conflict between Shia on the one hand and Sunni on the other. As a matter of fact, in Yemen, you can see almost if these events unfold because at least the president who's now stepped down, he was allied with the United States, who was in conflict with the Shia movement, which is also in conflict with al-Qaeda, which is Sunni. And we now, of course, see ISIS coming in as well. So I mean, it seems like this thing is very multifaceted.
Absolutely. The sectarian dimension that you alluded to between Sunni and Shia adds a whole level of complexity. The dispute between Sunni and Shia is really an argument over who should have been the successor to the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. It's not a big theological argument over how many angels you can put on the head of a pin. Put another way, It's an argument that cannot be resolved because you can't go back and change what happened. But it has become a very malicious point of this whole struggle between al-Qaeda and the rest because al-Qaeda has exploited the sectarian divide very, very consciously in order to whip up hatred. And, of course, also because our ally, Saudi Arabia, for a long time has played the Sunni-Shia card too in its rivalry with its great opponent in the Persian Gulf, the Iranians.
Bruce, what should we be doing differently? And I want to stay for just a moment on radical Islam and the radical theology of Islam that I believe comes from Abdallah Azzam and others. Christianity went through a modernization period in which the kind of politicized religion and the fundamental nature of the religion began to liberalize and take on a more modern characteristic. Is that happening in Islam at all?
It's happening in parts of Islam. One of the great success stories in the Islamic world today is Indonesia. Indonesia is actually the largest Muslim country in the world. It has held democratic elections. It's had stable, peaceful transitions of power from one elected leader to another. It has a much larger role for women in its society. And Indonesia has successfully defeated its local version of al-Qaeda, at least for now. Because if you remember, a decade ago, Indonesia was the scene of some of the worst terrorist violence in the era right after 9/11, the Bali bombings, the nightclub bombings, attacks on hotels. Indonesia provides an example of how an Islamic country seems to be able to make this transition. There are others. Morocco, a monarchy, but a monarchy in which there is a democratically elected parliament. So there are places where it happens, but I would argue the reason it happens in those places have very little to do with America and almost everything to do with Indonesians and Moroccans. What we could do better, I think, is articulate our support for democratic processes in these countries. I think, for example, we made a big mistake in 2013 when the coup took place in Egypt in not immediately saying, this is a coup. I'm not saying that the Muslim Brotherhood government was a great government, but it was a democratically elected government. And even bad governments, democratically elected, should be thrown out at the ballot box the next time, not by tanks in the street. I think we missed a big opportunity there to make clear where we stand on these issues. Now, don't get me wrong. I know this is hard. Saudi Arabia is our most important ally in the Arab world. And President Obama is going there not to talk about human rights. He's got a lot of other things on his agenda, the top of which, of course, is cheap oil prices, which I think is what most Americans want him to talk about in Saudi Arabia. These issues are hard. There are very big trade-offs that have to be made. In the end, the critical decisions about the future of Islam are going to be made by Muslims. I just think we ought to better align ourselves with those Muslims who want to support democratic change, who want to try to change their societies in a nonviolent way.
We're very pleased today to have an audience for our interview with Bruce. And I'd like to turn now to one of the members of our audience for a question. Give us your name and your question, please.
My name is Jonathan Kornstrom. Again, I'm a senior here at Salisbury, a political science major. I wanted to ask you, in regards to you described Obama's light footprint strategy, do you believe that our actions, like you said, against the coup in Egypt, in addition to other countries, say, is how we're funding moderate rebels in places like Syria, do you think that reflects a evolution in U.S. foreign policy or sort of a reflection back to the past, like you had mentioned before, of how we silently funded, you know, the Mujahideen against the Soviets? Are we returning to our old policies, or are we trying to completely leave the arena of being in direct combat and sticking mostly to financial backing?
I think we're searching for the answer. I think President Obama came to office elected on the promise that he would get us out of the Iraq War and that he would fight the Afghan War in a smarter way. Not surprisingly, 6 years into his presidency, he hasn't been able to fulfill all of his campaign promises. I think he's on to the right thing in one sense. 150,000 soldiers in Iraq was not the answer to the Iraq problem. We may have dealt serious blows to al-Qaeda in Iraq with those 150,000 men, but it's obvious now in 2015 we did not destroy al-Qaeda in Iraq. It simply mutated into the Islamic State. So that option, I think we can fairly safely say, tried, and we're not happy with the outcome. The approach that he has envisioned, the lighter footprint, isn't working all that well either. I wouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater yet. I think we're better to continue to fiddle with the lighter footprint option than to go back to the 150,000 boots on the ground option. But I think it still needs a lot more tinkering. But I guess my biggest point about all this is that a lot of this is out of our hands. Let's look at Yemen, for example. Yemen's never really had a strong central government. It's the poorest country in the Arab world. It's literally running out of water. Sana'a will be the first capital city in the world that does not have enough water to provide it to its inhabitants 24 hours a day. There's not an American solution to this. We can't find water for Yemen. We can't create unity in a country that has never known much unity. We can help. We also know we can do a lot of harm. First rule here is let's not do any more harm. We've done a lot of harm to ourselves over the last decade. As I alluded to earlier, I think the war in Iraq was a major self-inflicted wound on the United States. I think we're going to be in this for a long, long time to come. But I also think we ought to keep perspective on it. The president has wisely said that this kind of terrorism is not an existential threat to the United States of America. Let's draw a contrast between 1979 and 2015. 1979, our enemy in the world was the Soviet Union. It had somewhere like 300 divisions in its army. It had intercontinental ballistic missiles focused on every American city. We lurched from one crisis to another, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, the 1973 war. We're not in that period anymore. Yes, we have a problem, terrorism. It's a serious problem, no question about it. But it's not an existential threat to the survival of our republic or our way of life. And I think that perspective is very important when you think about what do we do next in all of this. Let's not overreact. Let's be careful and prudent in how we react.
Thank you.
Let's have another question from our audience. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Eric Rittinger. I'm an assistant professor here in the political science department. And I just have a question about what you think the effectiveness will be of the Afghan National Security Forces and the Iraqi National Security Forces, two militaries that the United States has been instrumental in creating and funding and training. The battlefield effectiveness against ISIS was not particularly spectacular, and there's still questions about desertions and battlefield effectiveness in the Afghan National Security Forces. So I was just wondering if you could evaluate those militaries as kind of extensions of kind of what we began.
Right. Well, the Iraqi case, as you alluded, we have the answer. After billions of dollars, the Iraqi security forces collapsed in the face of ISIS. I think a large part of that reason was political, not military. And it gets to the core of the Iraqi state. Iraq is an invention of Winston Churchill, drawn in a conference in Egypt in 1922. He put together Sunni, Shias, Arabs, and Kurds in an oddly shaped country that had never existed before. And to a large extent, I think that's why that Iraqi military experiment didn't work. And I'm pretty pessimistic that we're going to somehow, second time around, find a magic silver bullet solution that puts the Iraqi situation together. The Afghan situation, a little bit different. Afghanistan is a state that goes back to the 18th century. The modern Afghan state can trace its history longer than the United States of America can. There are divisions within Afghanistan between Pashtun and Tajik and others, but they're not as deep as the divisions between Sunni and Shia in Iraq. So I'm a little more optimistic in Afghanistan that the Afghan National Security Forces, with some continued American help, especially financing, can hold off the Taliban once all the American combat troops are gone. But it's a gamble. Nobody should have any illusion. This is a gamble. I had a part in helping to devise our strategy in Afghanistan back in 2009, and I said at the time, this is the best way out. It's in many ways the only way out, building up the Afghan army. But it's a gamble. At best, it has a 50-50 chance of success.
Thank you.
How do you assess the Afghan government? Because some have suggested recently that with Karzai, things really didn't work very well. There was apparently, when Obama came into office in 2009, one of the assessments was we were losing the Afghan war. Now, there was apparently some shifting around in terms of personnel on the Afghan level, which then allowed us to at least make gains. But how temporary are those gains? And is it likely that the current folks that are now in power, now that Karzai is out, will just allow themselves to slide back into that syndrome?
The new president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, somebody I know very well, he's a technocrat. He should also mention he's a Brookings scholar, or at least he was a Brookings scholar. He's the first Brookings scholar ever to become president of a country. Afghanistan may not have been the optimal place for Brookings to break into the presidents of a country club. I think he is much more pragmatic than President Karzai was, much more interested in a hands-on government and what can work rather than in the trappings of power. But there's a lesson in the Karzai experience. We picked Hamid Karzai. He was our guy. And then we systematically undermined him. We did things that snubbed him. For example, right after the 2008 election, Vice President-to-be Joe Biden went to Afghanistan on a fact-finding mission. And he got into an argument with Karzai at dinner and walked out of the dinner. Now, you don't walk out of a dinner of a foreign head of state in their turf. That's just not a smart thing to do. And don't be surprised if the head of state you've walked out on then starts saying nasty things about you. Hopefully we've learned a couple of lessons there. If we're going to pick foreign leaders, don't have buyer's regret later on. Or if you do, keep it to yourself. Again, Afghanistan is a gamble, and Ashraf Ghani is a better gamble than Hamid Karzai. But there's every chance that come 2016 or 2017, when American forces are all but gone, that this will unravel just like Iraq unraveled.
Bruce, there have been some marginal discussions of partitioning Iraq. Sunni area, Shia area, Kurdish area. Has ISIL basically precluded with their taking over so much territory in Iraq? Have they basically precluded that kind of solution, or is that any kind of solution at all anyway?
ISIS or ISIL now controls most of the Sunni Arab parts of Iraq. One of the reasons why they've stopped growing is, of course, the coalition airstrikes. A more fundamental reason is they took all of the Sunni Arab territory. They're not going to expand. They were never really likely to take Baghdad, because Baghdad is a predominantly Shia city. In a sense, they have partitioned the country. Of course, we can't live with a partition of Iraq, which leaves a terrorist organization which is determined to attack American interests, not just in Iraq, but in the region and someday perhaps in the United States as well, in control. But perhaps redrawing the borders of the Middle East and other places has merit. The international system that we built after World War II, though, is got a knee-jerk allergy to altering borders. Good example, Sudan. Again, the British put together northern, Muslim, Arab, primarily white Sudan with the southern Sudan, black, non-Islamic, non-Arab. It made sense if you were the British Empire and you wanted to control the world and to have a railroad from Cairo to Cape Town. Did it ever really make any sense for the Sudanese? After almost three decades of civil war, horrific violence, Secretary of State Colin Powell proceeded over a diplomatic solution that created a South Sudan. But it was, you know, fighting the whole basis of the international system, which argues that the borders that were created in 1945 when the UN was created are sacrosanct and cannot be changed except if everybody agrees that they can be changed. I think it makes sense in a lot of places to think about different kinds of borders, but the international system will have to be much more flexible in reacting to that kind of thing.
How sustainable is an entity like ISIS? It almost seems as if it's a relatively new kind of animal politically, because it's not something that grew up in organically, but rather it's something that reached in and opposed itself, even though it goes through the contours of the Sunni area. But how sustainable is that, or do you think that they will burn out, or whether we're looking at a semi-permanent fixture here?
I don't think it's sustainable in the long run for a variety of reasons, the most important of which is the very manner in which it operates.
Right.
Beheading people, slaughtering people, inevitably has a blowback. When the Taliban ran Afghanistan in the late 1990s, we can now see in retrospect a blowback was developing. The reason we were able to topple the Taliban in 2001 so easily was because they'd lost the support of the Afghan people. And I think the same thing is likely to happen in Iraq under the Islamic State. And to a certain extent, the smart American approach is to let the blowback do most of the work and then go in and deliver the finishing blows when they've already lost support of the Sunni man and woman in the street. The other thing that's not sustainable about this organization is that it has no concept of governance. They have slogans, a caliphate. Well, the last caliphate ended in the 1920s, and it hadn't been working for about 300 years before it went out of business. An Islamic state, what does that mean? What's the level of taxation in an Islamic state? The Quran doesn't tell you how much personal income tax rates should be. It doesn't give you formulas for choosing governors, things like that. Those have to be added on. It can be done. Obviously, Saudi Arabia is an example of an Islamic state that has developed all of that. But I don't see in the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, that level of governance. What we have here is an insurgency, a terrorist organization, which is much more into the business of terror than it is in the business of governing.
They have broken the prime rule of insurgent organizations by controlling territory.
Absolutely.
Will that be a significant downfall for them, do you believe?
I think so. One of the things we're seeing going on in the global jihad movement today is a struggle between al-Qaeda on the one hand, the originators of the global jihad, and the Islamic State, ISIL, ISIS, whatever you want to call it. The old guard, if we can use that term for al-Qaeda, believes that the emphasis should be on terror attacks, especially in the West. The new guard, the new guys, the young Turks, if you like, ISIS is saying, no, we don't. We can go right to the caliphate. We can create a state. We can do it right now, and we're doing it. And I think they're making the mistake you alluded to, which is to go from guerrilla warfare, terrorist warfare, to holding territory. It's a lot easier to go after these guys if they're operating out in the open, if they're trying to run cities, if they're trying to make oil sales. And in that sense, I think what we're likely to see is that a couple of years from now, the old guard will be saying, "We told you so," to the young Turks.
Bruce, we have a couple of minutes left, and you alluded to this earlier. But what is the future that we're looking at, and what is this perspective that we need to develop that you mentioned a few minutes ago? We're Americans, and we believe you go in and you fix it up and you get it done and you get out and everything can be fixed, and it can almost be fixed right now. And I think you said in one of our prior conversations, it's in our DNA to go in and fix stuff. Perspective means holding back a little bit. Perspective means waiting out, waiting for things to happen. Tell us how that will work for us.
Well, let's draw an analogy. When the Cold War began in the late 1940s and early 50s, President Truman created a policy of containment. He wisely decided that we couldn't invade the Soviet Union and Communist China. We couldn't roll back communism. Now, that was a very controversial at the time. Ironically, the Republicans who argued for that won the next election. But General Eisenhower was smart enough to know there's a difference between campaign rhetoric about rollback and going to war with the Soviet Union and Communist China. And we embarked upon containment. We embarked upon a long-term solution to the problem. We built a national security bureaucracy to do that. We recognized that this was going to be an ongoing expense, and we funded it in the budget. As I've said earlier, I don't think the threat we face today is as serious as that threat. It's a serious threat, but it's not an existential threat. We're not going to go to nuclear war with al-Qaeda. Thank God they don't have nuclear weapons. They're not Hitler's Germany. They're not Stalin's Russia. They don't control vast industrial machines. I think we do have to think in terms of a long-term approach. I don't know what we call it, containment or something like that. We have to think about our defenses. We have to think about how we can try to prevent the development of sanctuaries and safe havens, or how we're going to live with some that we can't get rid of. I think we have to recognize that this will mean certain changes in our national security system. It will mean hardening of our airports and things for the foreseeable future. It will also mean that we have to fund this not on an extraordinary basis, but but as part of our budget. But it also means not panicking and not doing things that we don't need to do. And what do I mean by that? We don't need to torture anyone. If we could defeat Nazi Germany without torturing U-boat commanders captured, I think we can defeat Al-Qaeda without torturing people. It also means not giving up our freedoms and our liberties. We don't have to have the national security state listening to every phone conversation, reading every email in the United States. They ought to have the authority in extraordinary circumstances to do things like that on a selective basis. But I don't think we have to give up the fundamental values that make us Americans. We're in this for the long haul. It's going to have some bad days, the Boston Marathon, the Paris attacks.
Bruce Riedel, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your insights and your extraordinary experience and knowledge on the Middle East and South Asia with us. We are certainly better off for your wisdom, and we're very pleased that you have the ear of the President of the United States as well. Thank you very much for that. And Don, thank you also for joining us as well. We appreciate that. And thanks particularly to Dr. Michael O'Loughlin and the Political Science Department at Salisbury University for joining us in our discussion. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.